Sardinian sheep herders, Japanese grandmothers, and Seventh-day Adventists in Los Angeles don't seem to have that much in common. But within these groups, there are some of the longest-living people in the world. Author Dan Buettner has scoured the earth not for the fountain of youth, but for the key to happy old age. He spent 5 years visiting areas of the world where people live longest and are the healthiest, and he's tagged these hotspots blue zones. Dan Buettner joins us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Dan, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted.
So you were traveling the world looking for these pockets of people who were living into long age. And I was wondering if you could just give us a sense of what came to define what a blue zone was and how did you find them?
Well, we partnered with National Geographic and the National Institute on Aging and then a number of demographers, mainly in Europe. And these demographers use census data, and they look, first of all, for countries that have the longest life expectancy, and then we look for the particular regions. One place, Sardinia, for example, has the highest number of male centenarians in the world. Okinawa has the longest disability-free life expectancy. The Adventists in Loma Linda, California, have a life expectancy of 9 to 11 years greater than their American counterparts. The Nicoya Peninsula of Costa Rica is a place where middle-aged mortality is lowest. In other words, middle-aged people have about a four-fold better chance of reaching age 90 than we do here in America.
One of the most striking parts of the book is hearing the voices of the people you interviewed. And tell us, who's the most sort of, say, striking centenarian you might have met?
Giovanni Lanai in Sardinia is a 104-year-old man. When we came to see him at 9 o'clock in the morning, he was chopping wood. He poured us a glass of Cannonau wine for breakfast. He's not an alcoholic or anything. That's just the way he started his day. And over the hour or so that we interviewed him, we saw a steady parade of people who came in for his advice. It was one of the characteristics of the Sardinian Blue Zone. The older you get, the more celebrated you are.
And so looking in the U.S., where there was at least one blue zone, it's a small area, surprisingly, outside of L.A., about 60 miles outside of L.A., what are the things there that you think they're doing differently?
The blue zone we chose in the United States, we found among Seventh-day Adventists, and it was more a cultural blue zone than it was a geographical one. Loma Linda, California has the highest concentration of Adventists anywhere. They take their diet inspired directly from the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, where God says he's provided his people grains, nuts, and seeds. And so they have a plant-based diet. Every week, they take their Sabbath, Saturday, very seriously. They call it the sanctuary in time. And no matter how busy, no matter how stressed out they are, they'll take that 24 hours and focus on their God. And then the other interesting thing about their culture is they tend to hang out with each other. At least the Adventists I interviewed, most of them would say that 90% of their immediate friends are also Adventists. So their social circle is very much supportive of the right habits.
Now, the science of aging is certainly in its early days in a lot of ways. And although we do know that there's a sort of complex interplay between your genes and the environment that factor into someone's health and longevity, what are the things that you can tell us about the people you spoke to in terms of shared patterns?
Well, I can tell you they didn't take any supplements or pills or wine extracts. They tended to live in houses and environments that nudged them into bursts of physical activity in kind of an effortless way. And Okinawans sat on the floor. Sardinians lived in vertical houses. The Costa Ricans had gardens. So they were doing little things all day long that added up significantly over the years and the decades.
What are some of the things you heard from these folks that went against the grain, went against the obvious stuff you should do if you want to live a long life?
One of the idiosyncrasies we discovered is that people who eat nuts, four to five times a week, 2 ounces a time, tend to live 2 to 3 years longer than people who don't eat nuts. That was a big surprise for us.
Ah, so you're justifying my pistachio habit.
Yeah, you can dig into those, yes. I think we think the paragon of physical activity is running marathons and triathlons and pumping iron and looking really good. I think the four biggest things you can do is create an environment where you're nudged into physical activity, set up your kitchen in such a way that you're not overeating, cultivate the sense of purpose, and then take the time to surround yourself with the right people. These are long-term fixes that have been shown over and over to add not only more years of life, but better years of life.
Explorer and writer Dan Buettner is the author of The Blue Zones, Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who Lived the Longest. He joined us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul.
Thank you.
I believe in mystery.
I believe in family.
I believe in being who I am.
I believe in the power of failure.
And I believe normal life is extraordinary.
This I believe.
Our This I Believe essay today comes from 26-year-old listener Colin Bates of Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. Bates has worked as a video store clerk, a waiter, a landscaper, and in construction. But it's the job he's doing now that's taught him his belief. Here's our series curator, independent producer Jay Allison.
Ever since high school, Colin Bates said, he felt a little like he was asleep in his life and work. He didn't finish college and was living what he called an unhealthy, selfish life. Until 3 years ago, when he happened to see an ad for the job he has today. Here's Colin Bates with his essay for This I Believe.
Most of my friends have recently graduated from college. Every so often, one will call me up to grumble about their new job, telling me how underappreciated they feel or how they're not achieving the success they wanted. I enjoy listening to them. I think that's what friends are for. But it also gives me perspective on my own work. I work with two developmentally disabled men, my bosses essentially, who each have profound mental retardation. They're loud without being able to speak. They're violent without understanding the consequences. They can't bathe themselves. They can't cook or work a job. Their behaviors range from catatonic to aggressive. As a resident service assistant, I go to where these men live and help them in everything they do. Bathing, dressing, cooking, feeding, cleaning, going to the bathroom, from the moment they wake until they go to bed. It pays $9 an hour. Underappreciated? Try having your hair ripped out while changing a diaper. Try having the meal you've prepared thrown at you. Try being spit on. The funny thing is, I love my job. I do. I know I'm young and still have a lot to learn, but here it is. I believe in helplessness. Which is to say, I believe we need other humans. It isn't enough to be what our society has dubbed as successful. What we really need are others around us engaging, nurturing, listening, and willing to sacrifice their time and agendas. I don't care if you're the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company or a single mother with five kids. Nobody is completely self-sufficient, and so, in that way, we're all helpless. We're helpless unto each other. The cool thing about the guys I work for is that they make their needs explicit. Things that take seconds for most of us, like changing socks, can take hours for them. But their vulnerability isn't a handicap so much as an example. Being with them, encouraging them, yes, the socks are on, the socks are off, puts things into perspective. Most of the people I know are embarrassed by what they can't do. They see it as a sign of weakness and consequently walk around with burdened hearts. For my generation, the notion that success equals fulfillment has been pounded into our brains as if it was the truth. My generation is being told that if you can't do something alone, if you're not smart enough or capable enough, then you failed. So far, the turning points in my life have not been the times I succeeded at something, but the times I've whispered, I'm lost, or help me, or I need a friend. In becoming helpless, I've allowed myself to be shaped and supported by those who love me, which makes helplessness a gift. And I have my bosses to thank for it. We've discovered the joy of helping and being helped. I believe, sometimes, our vulnerability is our strength.
Colin Bates, with his essay for This I Believe. Bates says he works up to 90 hours a week, while still taking classes towards his college degree in English. Bates wrote his essay in a bargain with his father that they would both write essays. He wants his father to know the offer still stands. And if you want to write an essay, our offer is still good too. At npr.org/thisibelieve, you can find out more. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Jay Allison is co-editor with Dan Gediman, John Gregory, and Vicki Merrick of the book This I Believe, The Personal Philosophies of Remarkable Men and Women.
Support for This I Believe comes from Prudential Retirement.
The work of Erik Satie is seminal to a range of 20th century music. You can hear it in French minimalism and modern electronica. Even if you don't know Satie's name, you probably know his music. This is the Gymnopédie No. 1 for solo piano. Satie was an eccentric guy who lived in a wild time, Paris, in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It was the height of the avant-garde, and Satie's work has only gained influence over time. Guitarists Jonathan Stone and Adrian Bond approach music from radically different perspectives, but they've come together to perform Satie's music. It's a collaboration project they call the Phonometrics. Here's their interpretation of the Gymnopédie No. 1. I'm joined in NPR's performance studio by Jonathan Stone and Adrian Bond, performing their arrangement of Erik Satie's Gymnopédie No. 1. Welcome. Thanks for coming into our studios.
Thanks very much for having us.
Why is Satie still relevant? Why reinterpret Satie for guitar? Jonathan Stone.
His music is still relevant because it was unique in its time, and it was a departure in its time. And in a way, to me, Satie creates a kind of timelessness in much of his music. So it's just as fresh now as it was 100 years ago.
Adrian?
And also, when Jonathan introduced me to Erik Satie back in the, I guess it was the late 70s or early 80s, and I had already been familiar with the ambient movement, which sort of led to John Cage and, you know, other strange sort of more avant-garde stuff. So that when the first time that I heard Erik Satie, it was more like recognizing something that had influenced all of the people that had influenced me. And it was instantaneously familiar and perfectly relevant.
One of the things that's so fascinating about you guys playing together is that, Jonathan Stone, you're a traditional bossa nova and samba player. And Adrian Bond, as you say, you're an ambient electronic musician, for the most part. How do you find common ground in Satie's work?
A common taste for the bizarre, I suppose. We tend to admire eccentric characters who take things on their own terms and develop something entirely new out of thin air.
The Gymnopédie is so well known that I can't just listen to that piece and say, wow, this guy was doing something really different. Can you give me a sense of what he was doing in his time that was so different from other people?
It's often said that Satie's music achieves its effects despite or maybe because of his lack of technical musical erudition or technique. One thing that guided him, I think, was this anti-authoritarianism. Whenever he encountered a rule or someone telling, and he had a lifelong antipathy to the academy and the official methods of composition. So when he heard there was a rule, he immediately just broke it and just stayed there, breaking it.
This was not a guy in early 20th century Paris who was doing what everyone else was doing.
Right. One of the things that makes Satie truly barbaric is the aggressive application of the flat five atonality.
That's a flat fifth?
Yeah. And it has obviously sort of a tense and harmonic feel. And it was an interval that was literally to be avoided. In fact, in liturgical music, it was essentially illegal.
Why?
Because my understanding is that it was sort of representative of the flaw in God's plan in a strange way, that in this beautiful harmonic series, you get eventually this interval that's very challenging to listen to.
Is there a piece you all play that gives a sense of this?
Absolutely. Nocian No. 3 would be a perfect example of the aggressive use of the flat five.
Nocien number 3, Eric Satie's piece there, played by Jonathan Stone and Adrian Bond here in Studio 4A. Now, I understand that Satie wrote notes and commentaries in the margins of his work, or actually they're instructions for playing the music in his sheet music, right?
Well, you would find that in almost any kind of music, a marking like allegro or dynamic indications, but he took things into the realm of personal psychology. Give you advice about your state of being as you were playing the music. Don't be proud, for example.
Think like a pear.
And these things, it came into style in early 20th century Paris, right?
Well, he became famous for these absurdist little humorous asides.
So much so that by the teens, he was actually having to request that people not read them out loud when the pieces were played. So we thought it might be fun to ask you to read one out loud.
Okay.
This piece is actually a bit different. There's an actual narrative.
What is this piece?
It's one of the small pieces from a collection called Sports and Divertissements called Yachting.
Okay. Shall we try this?
Let's do.
What weather? The wind is heaving like a seal. The yacht is dancing.
No, you're doing great though.
Okay.
I couldn't have done it with a straight face either, so.
Let's try that again. What weather? The wind is heaving like a seal. The yacht is dancing. She's behaving like a little fool. The sea is quite out of hand. Let's hope she won't crash on a rock. Can no one calm her down? I don't want to stay here, says the pretty passenger. It is not amusing. I prefer something else. Call me a cab. See why why the surrealists like this guy.
It influences avant-garde music through the 20th century, and it also appears in bank commercials. I mean, it's very popularly accessible, and yet people on the fringe trying to do something unprecedented find inspiration from him as well.
Adrian Bond, Jonathan Stone, thank you both for joining me here in the studio.
Thank you, Andrea. It's been great.
Thanks again for having us.
And would you play us out with something? Tell us what it is.
Love to. I think we'll do the Nocian number 5. Jaunty little piece.
There's more of our studio session with Adrian Bond and Jonathan Stone at npr.org/music. If history is a guide, some of those who suffer in the Iraq War will turn their experience into art. One man does it with World War II. He witnessed the first nuclear attack in history, August 6, 1945. A U.S. aircraft dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. About 140,000 people were killed. This survivor of Hiroshima grew up to become one of Japan's greatest artists. He's still active. Robert Rantz sent us this story.
Hiroshima today is a thriving metropolis of 1.2 million that speaks with the rumble and squeal of streetcars and traffic. But in 1945, the shattered city produced cries of despair that have echoed in art ever since. Polish composer Krzysztof Penderecki tried to capture the horror in music in 1960. American novelist John Hersey wrote the nonfiction book Hiroshima a year after the bombing. But in Japan, it was one of those on the ground that day, Ikuo Hirayama, who translated the experience into painting.
On that day, I saw the B-29 flying over my head. Three things dropped from the plane with something black at the end of them, and I was wondering what it was. I went to a small house where my friends were and told them that something unusual was happening, and then it exploded.
Hirayama is now a septuagenarian with a shock of white hair and kindly, sympathetic eyes. He was 15 years old when the atomic bomb detonated. He later learned what he had seen were monitoring cameras dropped by the Enola Gay to record a bird's-eye view of the bombing and its aftermath.
There was a powerful flash right in front of me. I covered my ears, and there was a strong wind, and I squatted down, and the wind went right over my head. And I then tried to escape through waterfalls of fire. Fire everywhere. The sound of fire was extreme.
Hirayama grew ill from radiation sickness. His white blood cell count plummeted. He nearly died.
I realized that it was not my effort that saved me. I was kept alive by something else.
Mystified by his recovery, Hirayama turned to Buddhism.
All my friends died. I felt guilty and helpless, very guilty that I survived. I picked Buddhism to honor the dead.
After the war, Hirayama abandoned Hiroshima. With his health restored, he took up painting, adopting an ancient technique called Nihonga, in which colors are blended from ground-up mineral pigments, then attached to the canvas with glue. By the time Hirayama returned to Hiroshima in the 1960s, he was famous as a painter of Buddhist images and of the highway that brought Buddhism to Japan, the Great Silk Road. Hirayama has visited that ancient throughway stretching from the Middle East and Central Asia through China more than 200 times. He says he has stopped at every oasis.
The Silk Road is within him, and he expresses it by painting.
Bill Clark heads the Clark Center for Japanese Art and Culture in Hanford, California. The center hosted Hirayama's first U.S. exhibition last year. Clark has visited Hirayama's studio in Kamakura, outside Tokyo.
you walk in and there will be a big canvas which he's painting, which will be a scene of the Silk Route, maybe camels walking across the blazing desert, or maybe camels walking at night in moonlight, but you sense what he is feeling.
Hirayama's Silk Road paintings look like postcard views of ancient landscapes and archaeological landmarks. The canvases are large and straightforward, but they've defined the Silk Road for Japan and have earned the painter a wide audience here. They convey Hirayama's belief that the Silk Road, with its exchange of commerce and ideas, show that cultures can interact constructively. It's a sense of hopefulness and cooperation, peace and tranquility, the antithesis to Hiroshima, 1945. The peace bell at Hiroshima's Atomic Bomb Memorial Park confronts visitors with an anguished peal. When Hirayama finally returned to Hiroshima 2 decades after the bombing, he went to the park and was drawn by the hiss and flicker of a flame honoring the dead.
The color of the fire, which was orange, reminded me of the day of the bombing, and I could not get rid of that color behind my eyelids.
Hirayama immediately began sketching out what would become one of his most powerful works, a huge 6-paneled canvas called The Holocaust of Hiroshima.
It's interesting how the composition works. The city is kind of pushed down to the very lower edge of the painting.
Dan McKee is curator of the Clark Center for Japanese Art and Culture.
And you just see the ruins of the skyline. And above that, a blood-red sky filled with wisps of dirty clouds. In the middle of the sky, on the upper right, is the Buddhist god of wrath looking down, wrath kind of raining down onto the city, the horror of the moment expressed in the brightness of the red-orange pigments.
Ikuo Hirayama says despite the sorrow and destruction portrayed in the Holocaust of Hiroshima, the painting offers a message of hope.
The Buddhist god is telling everybody to rise like a phoenix, to stand up and live for all eternity. I believe that flowers can blossom from anguish and inhumanity. You can overcome these things and make something beautiful.
Not long ago, Hiroshima's main art museum held a retrospective of Hirayama's work that included the Holocaust painting. While a replica of the painting permanently hangs in the city's Atomic Bomb Memorial Museum, this was a rare showing of the original. Scores of bombing victims came to see it. In 1945, Takato Kagayama's family lived in Hiroshima. He was working at a nearby naval base when the bomb went off.
I was born 1923. My parents and 2 sisters died.
Tell me what you think of the painting.
Very sad, he says. Yes.
The sadness of the Hiroshima experience informs all of Ikuo Hirayama's paintings. He has found, through his art, a sanctuary from the tragedy of 1945. For NPR News, this is Robert Rand reporting.
It's finally over. The long cliffhanging primary season has come to an end, and we've invited a very special politician slash musician to help ease us back into regular life. We're going to kick back and relax with some tunes at the piano here in NPR's Studio 4A. The person we have is Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, and the senator made a musical splash over Memorial Day weekend in a performance with the Memphis Symphony Orchestra, which you can catch in a video clip on YouTube. But we can do a lot better than that. We have Lamar Alexander here. He's graciously come by to give us a command performance and demonstrate his prowess at the piano. Senator Lamar Alexander, welcome.
Good morning.
Now, I promise we're going to get straight to the music, but of course, I have to get your take as a former presidential candidate on this long political season and give us your sense of what happened here.
Well, in the spirit of the interview, it is a symphony with too many movements. And this is a welcome interlude.
All right. Now, I want to hear some music. So Although we can't hear the whole medley that you did with the Memphis Symphony Orchestra, can you give us a little taste of Memphis?
Well, it sounds a lot better with the Memphis Orchestra, but this is one piece that people might remember. Called Memphis, Tennessee.
Well, it's a great piece, and it's making me think of the fact that I've read that you've played the trombone as well as even the washboard, and you've settled here with the piano. I mean, are people surprised to learn about these other talents?
Well, they might be. When I was a law clerk for Judge Wisdom in New Orleans, right after I went to law school in the 60s, I wasn't making much money, so I went down to Bourbon Street, and I played at a place called Your Father's Mustache, which has since burned down, and I played for whomever was off in the banjo band. So one night I played the trombone, and one night I played the tuba, and two nights I played the washboard with a spoon.
We should have asked for that.
No, you shouldn't.
So you started playing when you were four. Can you talk about where did you play?
I played in I took piano lessons. I played in little competitions. My dad led the singing at a lot of revivals, so I learned to play church music, and for example, like this.
I think of soul and the blues or country music, and I often think of gospel and some of the roots of the Tennessee music and revivalist meetings. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about who are the players that really influenced you as a piano player.
Well, my music teacher would try to, I'd come in sometime and she'd notice my left hand is jumping. She'd say, "You've been playing that Jerry Lee Lewis stuff again." But growing up where I did, we heard the mountain music. And then I heard Chet Atkins and with his new guitar style, and Dolly Parton was on the radio. And about that time, the 1950 Sun Records was attracting Carl Perkins and Elvis Presley and the Blackwood Brothers. And my piano playing over here was classical piano playing, but I was hearing on the radio and learning to play by ear a lot of this other music.
And in the YouTube video, it sounded a little bit like the Jerry Lee Lewis influence survived. And I was wondering if you could play a little bit more of some of that music for us.
Yeah, I can play a little bit. Kind of the way it goes and just keeps going.
And you've been known to kick back a piano bench or two.
Well, I did a long time ago. When I was governor, I was looking for ways, and this was a little while ago in the 80s, I was looking for a way to unify our state, which is a big, long state, runs from Bristol, where the Carter family started, to Memphis, where the blues is. And I realized music is about the only thing that unifies Tennessee. So I put some money in the community and symphony endowments, challenged them to match that, and then I went around the state and I played concerts with 21 different symphonies and community orchestras, and people came out in big numbers to see the governor make a mistake.
It sounds like that didn't happen. It sounds like those were very people really enjoyed those performances.
Well, they did, but they knew not to expect too much of me, and I used to tell the directors, they'd say, "What's your goal here?" And I'd say, "My goal is to finish my piece at approximately the same time the symphony finishes its piece."
Well, luckily this time around, it's just you and me, and so the song I'm going to ask you to finish with is one that you actually recorded with Patti Page, and that's the Tennessee Waltz. First, I want you to tell us the story about how you ended up recording with her.
Well, there were two old boys from Tennessee, Red Stewart and Pee Wee King, after World War II, who were driving from Memphis to Nashville. And one said to the other, "Well, why does Kentucky have a waltz and Missouri have a waltz and Tennessee doesn't. And that was before the interstate, so they broke out an old penny matchbox and wrote the Tennessee waltz on the back. And then Mercury Records in New York had a song they thought would be a big hit called Boogie Woogie Santa Claus, and they got the hottest young singer, Patti Page, to sing it. And they had nothing to put on the back of the record, so they just grabbed this Tennessee waltz and put it on the back. And last year in Nashville, Mike Curb of Curb Records invited Patti Page in to record again.
Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee waltz.
And I got to play the Tennessee waltz with Patti Page at the Nashville Symphony Hall that many years after 1950 when it was first recorded.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Tennessee Waltz. Senator, I remember you best for the red and black flannel shirt from your presidential runs and the sort of Lamar with the exclamation mark on the bumper stickers. And it's really different to see you here so relaxed and like sort of enjoying playing. And I'm wondering, you know, when do you find yourself playing if you don't play in public that often?
Well, I've got pianos at home. I've got we live in East Tennessee. I've got a little Steinway upright piano there. In Nashville, I've got a Steinway D, and here in a very small home in Washington, I've got a Steinway B. So when I get home from the Senate at 8:30 at night, I sometimes go to the piano and play.
And what does it do for you, I guess?
Well, it relaxes me. I started out playing Mozart and Chopin and Jerry Lee Lewis, and I've ended up playing Bill Evans and George Shearing and mellower jazz. So I enjoy doing it. And I would say this to young people who might be, you know, teenagers and tired of piano lessons. I find that today I can play what I learned when I was 15 about 70 or 80% as well as I could play it then. And I can do that without any practice today. So if you can stick with your piano playing long enough till you get to be 13, 14, 15, 16, something you can love the rest of your life.
Senator Lamar Alexander, thank you so much for coming in here and, you know, showing us this different side. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is a lot more fun than a hearing.
I remember the night and the Tennessee waltz.
You can see a video of Lamar Alexander playing in NPR's Studio 4A in the music section of our website, npr.org. There you can also get a sneak preview of the new recording of Patti Page with Lamar Alexander playing Tennessee Waltz. The CD will be released on Curb Records late this summer. Our feature was produced by Ned Wharton and recorded by Neil Tivault. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Leanne Hansen returns next week. I'm Audie Cornish. Over the course of the summer, we'll be sailing with Captain Fatty Goodlander. Captain Fatty is the editor-at-large of Cruising World magazine. He sent us a communique from aboard his sailboat, the Wildcard.
Ahoy. You know, I'm often asked, after a lifetime of sailing offshore and circumnavigating, which are my favorite destinations on our watery planet? And I always mention both Beveridge and Minerva Reefs in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, not for what they have, but for what they lack. There's no people there, no dirt dwellers. They're completely devoid of humanity. Even stranger, both Beveridge and Minerva have no land. They're landless atolls. They were islands, but gradually the tops of them eroded away, and they began to gradually sink beneath the surface of the sea. Luckily, their fringing, frothing coral reefs grew up faster than their islands sank down. Thus, there is a beautiful, pristine anchorage with 360 degrees of protection from ocean waves, but no land anywhere, except, of course, straight down 50 or 100 feet or so. And they're usually deserted, these lovely, lonely atolls, save for the occasional passing sea gypsy, such as myself. We find them utter magic. Tranquil, tiny green lakes in the middle of a deep blue sea, completely devoid of people, yet teeming with life above and below the surface. Since we have no schedule, since the ocean voyage itself is our ultimate destination, my wife Carolyn and I often spend a month or so within their warm, sweet, watery embrace. Whales regularly come here to calf. In the 3 weeks we were anchored at Beveridge, there was never a time when, if we were still and quiet, that we couldn't hear whales softly blowing within our lagoon. Sharks, of course, are also ever-present. Every day we swim, and that means every day we swim with sharks. We try not to hassle them, and they don't hassle us. But if one shark gets circling tighter and tighter or gets a little too aggressive, we just slowly retreat to our dinghy. Because you don't want to try and outswim a shark any more than you want to try and outrun a bear. You know, it's strange to be in the water with such an evil, callous, fearsome predator, but luckily the sharks don't seem to mind. The sad reality is, if life were actually fair and just, sharks would immediately eat us on sight, for it is us who slice off their fins and leave them to die in tilted, sinking agony. It is us who is killing, murdering, mutually shared planet, not them. But most sharks are, thankfully, a lot better mannered than most people. Time seems to stand still here. We eat, we sleep, we make slow, gentle love. The big picture is easy to see. Things seem in balance. There's a yin and a yang. We seem in harmony. Answers seem clear, especially at night. Under a canopy of stars so close, we have to be careful not to breathe on them. What is life, really, but a series of moments, some precious, some not? For National Public Radio, I'm Captain Fatty Govander, reminding you to mind the rudder or meet the rock.
You can track Captain Fatty's progress on the Wildcard and hear more of his essays at our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.